I don't know if the word is, if the phrase is taken seriously, but to review the book as a book, you know, and not review it as a book written by an actor, which is a strange thing to do. You know, reviewers will often say, you know, I'm reviewing a book by an actor, which they don't say if they're reviewing a book by a policeman or, you know, any other kind of. It's like we are somehow handicapped mentally, which may be true. So now I understand that, but I'm happy. I mean, I think of it as a. It's going to sound pretentious, but I think of it as a work of literature, and I would like it to be seen that way. You know, I write it as I'm serious. It's going to sound like I'm taking myself seriously, but I write seriously. I mean, I think it's a funny book, but I mean, I take it seriously, and I feel that it's a work of art, and I want it. I don't want it to be dismissed as just some actor thinks he can write, you know, which I get, but that doesn't happen to be the case.
Taking us back to the beginning, let's talk about the dedication. Who are Ami and Jules and Gringo's number one and two?
They're the same people. Ami is my father, whose name was Amram, but he was known to all his friends as Ami. And Jules was my best friend's dad, who was known as Julie. So it was Amy and Julie. They were called by the Puerto Ricans on the softball team. Amy and Julie were the only Caucasians on the team. And they were Gringo number one and Gringo number two. So it's the same. Amy and Julie are Gringo number one and Gringo number two. And that's my dad and my best friend's dad. And we still argue over who was Gringo number one and who was Gringo number two. But it's also dedicated to my best friend as a kid, young Matty Warshaw, because we used to pal around on weekends. My father and Matty's father played on this team, and they would play for like $5 a man, which was significant in 70, 71 for my dad and for these people. And they were seriously competitive games, so we'd play all over Manhattan. Sometimes even into Brooklyn, and it's just the great memories of my childhood is traveling around on weekends with my dad, and he was a great pitcher. He couldn't hit at all. He was like Bucky Dent. He couldn't hit, but he could pitch. He was a great pitcher.
And who is Meg, who taught me more about writing than she knows?
That's my mother, my mother Margaret Miller Duchovny, and she's. She became, after my parents divorced in 71, she went back to work. She went to work and became a teacher at Grace Church School, a beloved first and second grade teacher, and then head of the lower school eventually. Created an amazing career for herself out of nothing, really, out of desperation, really, to support. She had three kids at that point. And those are the only three kids she ever had. not at that point.
You don't know if any others.
No, I think I know. At this point, I think I know. My mother is Scottish, and my father is a Jew from Coney Island, and it's just a very very interesting mix of two different takes on the English language and on the human condition that I got growing up, for which I'm extremely grateful in retrospect. I feel like I got two very, very different views of what it's like to be on this planet and how to describe it.
How does Bucky fucking Dent go from a screenplay to this novel?
Well, I had the screenplay for quite a while. And I had gotten close to making it from time to time. And people would get interested from time to time. And the way to make an independent film is, it's a difficult thing because you've got to convince people to part with a few million dollars to take part in a business that's really bad, you know, that has very low rate of return. It's like gambling. It's basically like putting $3 million on red and walking away and hoping for the best. So usually the people with the money are pretty good with money, and they conceive easily that this is a stupid thing to do with their money. So unless they have billions, and this is just pocket change to them, it's hard to get people to invest in an independent film, because once you making the film is not the problem. You can make a film, but then it has to come out in theaters, and that's when the real problems start, is that theaters want to sell their popcorn, and they want full theaters, and the best way to fill their theaters is with the big movies that people know about. So once you made a film, even if you made it for a tiny amount of money, you have to advertise it, and you can see that you're just throwing good money after bad at that point. So it's a tough road. Making independent films. I don't know why I've gone off on that tangent. I guess I'm a little bitter. But we would get, you know, you also have to finance. Here's a little lesson. I mean, we're in deep, so I'm gonna keep digging. The way to make an independent film is to attach a quote unquote bankable star, and then you use that star to get foreign financing. So basically the people that are giving you their money are actually not even giving you any money. They're just saying, I'm going to get you money from somebody else in Germany or Japan. And I'm going to do that with so-and-so. And there's an actual chart of what people are worth, actors, what they're worth. And it changes daily. It's like the stock market. Like I could be hot one day and get you German money and not the next day.
So is Johnny Depp a penny stock now?
Johnny Depp is, you know, he's international. I mean, I don't want to answer your question in the way you asked it.
But Johnny, listen, you're not going to be blacklisted, we promise you.
Johnny Depp happens to be somebody you could probably make a small film with because of the international popularity of that Pirates thing. So that's the way I think of it, the Pirates thing. So anyway, long story kind of long, I got close to making it from time to time with different actors, and never got it together. And one day, a few years ago, after I'd done Holy Cow and just realized, well, I can do this. I mean, I can sit on my ass and write, and I can do it. I thought, well, Bucky fucking Dent, I could see that. Somebody had said you should make it a play, and I thought, no, you know, I'm going to sit down and see what it is as a novel. And then, you know, magical things started to happen as I wrote, because I had never, you know, a screenplay is mostly dialogue, right? Very little description. And once I started the first chapter inside Ted's head like that, I was like, oh, this is novel. This is a different thing from the screenplay, and it's going to be worthwhile.
And tell us, the main character, Ted, do you identify with him? And when this is adapted, not for the small screen, but for the big screen, big money, big Universal, Fox, or Warner, who plays Ted, you? Is that Leonardo DiCaprio?
Yeah, sure. I think Ted is not, you know, it's interesting because I think Neil Simon said, when asked, you know, what was autobiographical in his plays, I apologize if I'm getting this wrong, he said it's all autobiographical, even the stuff you make up. And in a way, that's true. But strictly, or as they said in the neighborhood I grew up, strictly, Ted is nothing really like me, and Marty, the father, is nothing like my father. The autobiographical details are really the time and the place and the softball. But it's odd to me to think that I would have not made it autobiographical in a way. I never saw you know, when I wrote the screenplay, I kind of fell in between Ted and Marty, age-wise. I knew that I couldn't play, I was too old to play Ted, and I was too young to play Marty, and I wouldn't be playing either of them. So I never really identified myself, but you know, life goes on and I get older, and you know, when we do make this movie with Warner Brothers, I think I'll probably play Marty.
Mariana, Marty's attractive caretaker. She has a very, very interesting quote in the book, in the novel. Death is not a story. It can't be faked. Please elaborate.
Well, she's a grief counselor. And and I haven't told this part of the story. I guess this is not autobiographical. This is just kind of to fill you in on how ideas have their gestation period. When I was scoring a movie that I actually did write and direct, that I got to make as an independent film, called The House of D, and we were scoring it, and what you do, I'm going to be telling some long stories. These stories have a little background. Is it okay?
Yeah.
All right, so when you, they're just kind of technical movie things, so I just let me know if it's terribly boring, but...
You love House of D.
You love, yeah, well, I'm not just talking about the film, but I mean just like the making of the film, but thank you. Before you score a film, you put a temp score on it, and that's when you go through your film and you take music from all other films that you like and you put that music on your film, and then you give it to the writer of the music and you say, hey, I want something like this. Interesting. I mean, I find that interesting because it's not like something that people really know. So you're sitting there with the guy who does the temp score and you're like, oh, he's like, oh, I've got this music from Jurassic Park that I thought would fit here during this love scene. And so you do that, and you just sit there, and you're like, yeah, I like the sound of that, you know, I like the strings, I like it electric, whatever. And we were sitting there, and the woman who was doing my music supervision was the, I'm not going to say her name, but she was the wife of a man who had died a couple of years earlier, quite suddenly. And the music supervisor's wife walked in the room and said, oh, hello, so-and-so. There was this odd moment between this woman who was supervising my music and this woman who was the wife of the temp score. And afterwards I asked, and she said, you know, when my husband died, she was the grief counselor that the hospital assigned to me. And I went to the hospital to... He died of a heart attack very suddenly, and I went to the hospital, and they gave me, you know, they gave me her. And this was the first time she'd seen her. And there was this connection. I mean, it was an amazing moment. I can remember it. I was sitting in the room, and they saw each other for the first time after a few years. And they had shared this incredibly intense relationship that lasted for an hour or two, maybe. And I didn't know that job existed, a grief counselor. I didn't know that this, and so I asked the temp scorer, I said, can you have dinner with me, you know, with your wife? Can we go out to dinner? I have an idea. I'm really interested in what she does. I'd like to hear about it. And that's kind of where the whole Mariana character came from, was this idea that there are people in the world whose job it is to help strangers grieve, you know, and not just strangers, but strangers with very different cultural ways of grieving. I mean, this woman told me fascinating stories about dealing with Buddhists, Jews, Hindus, you know, everybody deals with dead bodies in very different ways and dying in very different ways, and just a fascinating job. And I thought, yeah, I could fall in love with a woman like that. You know, or I could have Ted fall in love with a woman like that. Somebody who's that kind of empathic and tragic.
David, on a lighter note, every time Marty's health plummets, whenever the Red Sox lose, how did you game the system? How does Ted game the system with the VCR?
Well, luckily I set the movie because of the historical circumstance of Bucky Dent in 78. So I didn't have to deal with live tweeting and, you know, the constant refreshing of our information, which is just a horrible thing. So to game the system in a way to fake sports scores or to delay sports outcomes. You know, it used to be people would go, don't tell me what the score of the game is. You know, it's like you don't hear that anymore because nobody can get away from it. It's like, I'm taping it. Don't tell me. That doesn't work anymore. Everybody knows everything immediately. So luckily, as I said, this was 78. And again, luckily, the VCR actually was kind of a prototype in 78. So that was just serendipity. It was lucky for me that, you know, not everybody would know what a VCR was, but it was in existence, and perhaps the sports teams might use it. I just made all that crap up, but
explain to everybody what Ted actually does to keep his father's health up.
So Ted, who works as a peanut vendor at Yankee Stadium, kind of steals one of these VCRs with a bunch of game tapes, which I theorize, or I made up, that the Yankee coaches and trainers would have, as they do now, you know, they look at tape of players and they assess their weaknesses, their strengths. They look, like, if a player's in a slump, they'll try to see if he's got something that he's doing differently and try to fix it. So I just assumed that it's possible that the Yankees might have been on the forefront of that. And so Ted steals these VCR tapes where Boston has beaten the Yankees, where certain of their players have done really well against the Yankees. So when Boston is losing to the Yankees, Ted is able to put in a tape, and because his father has no idea what the fuck a VCR is, he's just like, why is the box flashing 12 all the time? He's like, no, that's the new cable box. It's the new cable box. So he's able to get away with it.
You have this great scene where Boxerain is playing Grateful Dead's Boxerain. What does Phil Lesh's song mean to you?
That's a good question, because I'm not a big Grateful Dead guy.
Well, you must have known something to put Boxerain in there, since it's a pretty powerful song.
Yeah, I didn't say I didn't love any of their songs, but like Ted not being autobiographical, that's one of the things. Like, I did not grow up a Deadhead at all. But Boxerain is such a beautiful song and such a beautiful concept. Such a poetic expression of love, of a gift, really. You know, it just seemed to me, when I heard that song, it's one of those songs where, I wish I'd written that, you know, and so I did, I guess. I quoted it. But, A Box of Rain. Yeah, it's a beautiful idea, and if you think of it from one person to another. And it's a beautiful song. So it was just one of those things where once I made Ted a pretty serious Deadhead, I started quoting. I actually had to go and listen to a bunch of Dead songs, because I didn't really know the catalog that well. I did know Box of Rain. They were kind enough to let me use quite a few quotations. And so was Walt Whitman.
Did he phone in from the dead?
Walt drives a hard bargain.
How do love, death, fatherhood, marriage, and sex define Ted and us as the reader?
Well, I can't remember all the words you used just now, but I think you pretty much covered it all. You know, I think it's hard for me to describe the book in just a few words, you know. But I think what the book means to me, if I may be so bold, and what it means to me is probably the least important person on the planet that it means something to, because you make something like this for others to make it mean something to them. So I kind of always hate it when people come out and tell you what they think of their own stuff. So I'm like, do you mind if I make up my own mind whether you're a genius or not? I used to watch Schwarzenegger come out. This is the best movie ever made. And he would do it every time, and he like believed it. And I was like, man, you're good. But I can't do that. I'm like, yeah, it's all right. It's all right. This movie's all right. I think it's all right. But what, kind of what Mariana says in the beginning, it's about how you tell the story. It's like we're all in a story. We're kind of cast on this planet. I'm just making this up right now, so forgive me. So we're cast here on this planet. We're all kind of find ourselves, oh, wow, I got a role. I'm a person. I got cast. Here I am. And, you know, it's kind of, as you mature, as you become an adult, you have the ability, you have the power, you have the choice to change the narrative, you know, to take control of the way you tell the story of your own life. And you can tell it to make yourself miserable. And none of it's true with a capital T. You know, none of it is the truth. But, you know, I've come to the conclusion at this stage of my life that the best way to tell the story is the way that it gives the most good to the most people. You can continue to tell it in a horrible way. It's legitimate. It has no less legitimacy than some happier way. But Ted says it to Mariana at the end. He says, you know, your story is kind of sad. Mine's kind of happy. This is not a quote. It's better written than this, I promise. You know, whose story should win? The happier one or the sadder one? Neither of them are true. But that's kind of what the book is about to me, is how do you tell your story?
Could you describe this hilarious story you have where Ted goes and meets with his New York book editor?
Yeah, that was in the screenplay too, to kind of set Ted up as an author. And he goes to his editor, who just destroys him and calls him basically an effete academic pansy intellectual. And Ted says, oh, thank you. You know, that's kind of what I was going for. So Ted writes very well. I kind of wanted to establish that Ted was a talented writer but had no subject. And that's kind of the beauty of what happens between him and his father, because his father gives him this crazy idea that he can't die until the Red Sox win it all, even though he's dying of cancer. So he gives his father this kind of crazy high concept idea, and it turns into the thing that unlocks Ted's genius in a way. It unlocks his ability to write. He starts to, by the end of the book, he starts to write about something. He's been opened up by his father's love for him. And the scene that you're bringing up is, I think it's funny, and I'll screw it up if I try to remember how it's funny, but the guy, he takes the piss out of Ted pretty well as being, you know, kind of an academic, dry, postmodernist novelist. You know, anybody but Dom DeLillo, you know, like if anybody else wrote what Dom DeLillo wrote, so they get that kind of shit, but Dom DeLillo gets all the praise. So he's kind of working in Dom DeLillo land, but, you know, the minor leagues of it, I guess.
He says, what does the book editor say something to the extent, before you're surreal, you need to be...
real, yeah. He also says, reading the book was like getting hit over the head with a baguette for 2 hours. That makes me laugh. Because it's not really that violent. Nobody gets hurt. It's not a three-day-old baguette. That might hurt. Fresh baguette.
Even though your dad published his first book at 72...
First novel. Published a few books before then.
First novel until he was 72. Why did Dad identify himself as a writer, even though he had a 9-to-5 job supporting the family?
Well, because that was his soul, you know, that was his he grew up, I think, his whole life. His father was a newspaper man, a writer. Moshe Duchovny was worked for the Forward, which was a Yiddish language daily newspaper in New York City. No applause for the Forward. So I can't read it. I couldn't have read it either. So his father identified as a writer, a journalist, and my father identified himself as a writer, and he just always said, I'm a writer. You know, that's what we do. That's what my family does, and we think. We write. My father was a thinker. He was a spacey kind of a cogitator, you know, and I was so happy for him when he published, because I think it was a circle that completed, and I think if he died before that, it would have been tragic for him. And I think he was very proud, and I know that I was very proud of him. If I can say that without sounding condescending, but it was beautiful. And inspiring that a man could publish a first novel at 72 and be like a hot young novelist at 72. And I just loved it, and I thought it was a great book too. It was called Coney, and it was reviewed very well in the Times, and that was my dad.
Never too late to get started.
No, I mean, it's an interesting thing. You know, on the one hand, you could say, oh, the vanity. But on the other, I say, oh, the persistence, and oh, the belief. And I tell it to my kids. I was just talking to my daughter today, and she's like, oh, I wish I'd learned how to dance. I'm like, you're 17. You know,
I know you got your like Zelig in Woody Allen's film. You could do any character. You could do anything. You haven't done comedy yet. You haven't done stand up comedy.
Oh, stand up comedy.
Yeah.
True. I have not. I probably will not.
Tell us, what attracted you to Princeton and Yale and literature? Is it because of your dad? What?
Princeton, I don't.
Sorry, I think we get some water. Or
just wine.
Wine.
Can they turn wine into water?
We wanted to disarm you.
I'm not sure why I chose Princeton. I think I was identifying myself as a writer as well, although I didn't know what form that would take, and. By the time I graduated Princeton, I really didn't know what I wanted to do. I thought I would write, and I thought that getting a job as a teacher at a college was probably the best way to make some kind of a living and have 4 months of the year off. I should just leave it at that. No, 4 months of the year off to write. To be able to follow my own path on my own. And I guess I was going down that road when I was at Yale and was going to get a PhD. But I just at that point I'd been in school my entire life, like one would be, but I was 24, 25, and I felt like I just had to get out of school, but I didn't know how to do it. I didn't have a trade. I didn't have anything I could do. So I became an actor. No, that's not really the truth. But I became an actor by I'm not methodical at all. I'll tell you. I'm a terrible planner, and I'm a terrible... My buddy always says, fail to plan, plan to fail. And I'm like, yes! So was at Yale, and I was like, okay, I'm gonna write, I'm gonna be a poet. Because that's what I'd written up until then. I'd written it in high school, I'd written it in college. I was able to study with Maxine Cuman at Princeton, which was a great thing, and James Richardson. So I'd written a good deal of poetry, and I was like, maybe I'm better suited for fiction. Like Faulkner was a failed poet. You know, I could be a failed poet too, and I could write fiction. I could write poetic fiction. I was like, but that still means I'm going to sit in this room alone. And I'm 23, and I'm sitting in a room alone. Not cut out for that, really. Temperamentally, I think I needed to be with people. So it's like, plays, I'll do a drama. I can write, and then we'll be on a stage, and I'll be working with people, and I won't have to sit alone in the room forever. And I was like, but if you want to write plays, maybe you should learn what it's like to say those lines that people say when they're up there. So I was like, I'm at Yale, I can maybe go take an acting thing with people. There's always actors running around. And there's all these little venues all over Yale. It's a big acting town, Yale. And they always need bodies. They basically need bodies. And then I just kind of wandered into a playwriting class, which is not legal. You're not supposed to be able to do that. But they let me stay there, and I was studying that. And then I met actors, and they said, we have a part in this thing, you know, but we don't have any actor, you know, we're running out of actors, we need just a body, you know, can you do that? I was like, I can do that. And so that's just how that all started. I was like, here's another, this is a real puzzle. Acting was a real puzzle. I didn't understand it. I didn't understand how they did it. So I kind of got interested in that.
What do you think the X-Files started off as a cult, went quickly from being a cult hit to being one of Fox's most popular shows? Why?
Why? I don't know. I think there are many answers to that question. The first and foremost, because I've been asked that question, and I think, first of all, it's a good show. You know, I think it's hard for bad shows to get very popular. It happens. But it's hard for them to last. So first, it has to be good. Whatever it does, you know, the camel, the elephant, whatever animal it is, it's got to be good at being a camel and an elephant. And it is good at being whatever animal it is. And I think at the time, Fox was a young, fledgling network. They had Married with Children. That's about it. So they kind of wrote us, you know. We were the first show that got any kind of critical acclaim for them, any kind of critical notice. You know, Fox at that point was Fox brought, not the news network, but the creative arm of the TV. It was kind of down and dirty and not great. So we were the first Fox show that got any kind of, hey, they're not so horrible. Or there's some intelligence behind this show. And then I think, you know, the frame of the show, the capacity of the show to kind of transform itself through so many different genres of horror, thriller, sci-fi, love story, comedy. There's no other show that I can think of that can actually exist and be itself in just about any genre you can think of. And somehow Chris Carter created this frame in 1993 that was able to expand and contract and be all these things. So I think the flexibility and the possibility of the show is endless, and I think that's exciting. I don't know otherwise. I also think that it was able to export itself, in that It's hard for American shows to catch on in other languages, especially comedy. Comedy is hard to translate. And comedy is very culture specific and can be very country specific. If it's not slapstick, if it's verbal in any way, it's hard to translate. I think that's why slapstick does actually translate. But something about The X-Files was universal. It was definitely an American show. It was set in America and often in the woods and in small towns and small town America. But there was something about the zeitgeist, the heart of the show was really just human. It wasn't American. It was about the capacity to wonder and to the need to, you know, I want to believe is the cast line. So it was like the need to believe. And I think that made it kind of a show of the world and not just of America in that moment when it started. But I think ultimately the short answer is that it's good.
Why is Hank Moody so likable, even though he is troubled on Californication? Sounds like you got a bunch of Hank Moody fans.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I think the key to Hank Moody from the beginning for me was, and the fun of playing it was, this is a guy who speaks his truth no matter what the consequences. And it's really the only time you can get away with that is in a movie or a television show. So I think that even though he is troubled and troubling and sometimes says things that are horrible and ridiculous, the fact that he doesn't back down and he doesn't lie about it is very charming in a way and very powerful, and was so much fun to play a guy who cannot help himself. But you know, it wasn't like he spoke the truth to power, but that's kind of the person that he was. He spoke the truth to bullshit, I guess is what he did. And there's something heroic about that. And I think he loved his woman, you know. And I think that's it was romantic as well, even though there was all this other nonsense going on. It was a very romantic show.
Last question before we open up to a couple audience questions. What is your next novel?
Well, I don't want to describe it because the more I talk about it, if I would talk about it, the less I do. The more I talk, the less I do. That should be on my tombstone. But it's set in New York. I can't seem to get away from New York as a setting. And it's set in the present day. And it will be told from inside the head of a woman. So I'll be writing as a woman. And that's about all. You know, it's going to be it's big. It's there's a certain amount of research that has been done, that needed to be done, and it's kind of in a magic surrealist mode, I would say. I've already said too much.
When does it debut?
That's impossible to say. It's not any. It's just a bunch of notes and right now. So next week.
On that note, when I take a couple of audience questions. Yes?
Does the acclaim of this book make you
want to write another book? Question was, does the acclaim of this book make me want to write another book, or does it make me nervous about writing another book? Neither. I think I just want to write, I just have some ideas that I think are novels in my head, and I want to get them out. Certainly I want nice reviews, you know, and I want people to buy the books and read them, and but in a way it can be paralyzing if you start to think about either getting away from a certain reception or trying to reach another similar reception. I think the next one is different enough, and I think the ones that, I mean, the Holy Cow, I think, was a very different animal from Bucky Fucking Dan, and Miss Subways, which is the next one, is going to be very different from Bucky Fucking Dan. So I think, I feel good in that the subject matter is changeable. You know, it's preferable always to have nice reviews, but in a way, you kind of have to empty your head of that when you sit down to write. It's the same with acting. Like, if there have been days, and I stopped reading my reviews as an actor a long, long time ago, because there were days when I'd be sitting, standing, whatever, doing a scene, and the words would come into my head from some asshole. You know? And because I don't remember anything good, you know, I'm only going to remember the clever bad stuff that's said about me. So I was like, nah, this is counterproductive. So if I can just clear my head and sit down, that's kind of the space I need to be able to get to.
Could you just talk a little louder?
I can try to repeat it. She said, thank you so much.
You're good at reading lips, I know.
You're what? An indie filmmaker. Oh, that, yeah. Yeah, well, that would be great, you know. In a way, I've kind of had this fantasy that somebody would read the novel and want to turn it into a film, and they do without me, you know, in a way. Because I would love to see it I'd love to see what people do with. Because I've seen actors take stuff and make it different. I've seen directors take material and make it different. And in a way, I've spent enough time with Bucky Fucking Dent that it doesn't have to be like the Bucky Fucking Dent industry. You know what I mean? Like, and here are the dinner plates. And in a way, maybe it's taken enough time of my life and that I have something else to do. So I don't know. But if you said that, can I make it as a film, here's $3 million, whatever, make it as a small film, I'd probably do that. But I'd also be thrilled if somebody said, hey, I've really got a vision, and it's different from yours, and I want to, you know, I would love that. I think.
Did you get your title from saying Rick fucking Springfield,
California? I'm in no mood for you, Rick Springfield. No, I got my title. It's actually in the acknowledgments. I think at the end of the book, I got the title because I was up in Massachusetts, and I'm from New York, as we know. And Bucky Dent is kind of he was a hero because he hit a big home run for the Yankees. But I was in Massachusetts at a summer home, and I heard there were a couple guys on the roof, and they were working on the roof of this old house. And I just heard one of them say, Bucky fucking Dent. And I was like, what? Like a dog. And because there is something about just saying Bucky fucking Dent that is pleasing. Even if you take away any connotation of human language, just the sound, Bucky fucking Dent, just works. So I was like, I'm Bucky fucking Dent. I like that. I was like, why? What did you just say, Bucky fucking? Did you just say Bucky fucking Dent? He was like, yeah. I said, well, what? And he's like, well, everybody. In New England. He's not Bucky Dent. He's Bucky fucking Dent. And in a way, the whole story revolves around the idea of a guy who is not expected to beat you, like in life. You know, that's kind of what the characters get to. It's like, I think at one point they say, the father says, it's never Mickey Mantle or Willie Mays or Babe Ruth that beats you. It's always Bucky fucking Dent. You know, it's the guy you didn't prepare for. And that's life, you know. So to me, and the father dies saying, God bless Bucky fucking Dent. You know, that's, to me, that's the whole story is in that. Because let me tell you, you know, we had talks. I mean, is there anything else we can call it? Because you can't say it I mean, I'm going to go out there and try to get people aware of it, try to get people to buy it. But I, you know, I try to say it on TV. It's hard to Google it. You know, everybody's like, well, how are you going to Google it? And I was like, I don't fucking care. But you do have to care. No, you do have to care. And I really do believe that probably if the book was named something else, which it couldn't be, because I thought, I tried to think of something else, it might sell more because it would be easier to Google. You know? Because it's like, because then we went through like F, exclamation point, asterisk, slash, or is it F asterisk C, you know, like, can we put the C in or do we just go like 2 and then the K? And I'm telling you, we talked a lot about this, the fucking part of it. And at one point it was just all like signs, Bucky, beep. And then it was in the Times it was a dash. So if you read that review in the Times and you maybe Googled it, you might not find it, you know. So I tried, I thought, what else can I call it? And the only one I came up with was the Nine Crowns, which was the name of the baseball team. And I actually like the Nine Crowns because it's kind of mystical. It sounds like Game of Thrones. But it is and should be and always will be Bucky fucking Dent.
Could we get somebody in the back?
Don't worry, you're, Kevin Smith was much more bitter about the independent film business than you are.
Kevin Smith is what?
Much more bitter about the independent film business.
Yeah, he's good, Kevin. I watched his thing. He did the whole thing on Prince that was hysterical that I saw. Kevin Smith, people.
If I remember correctly, Robert Hollander, the Dante professor, said that you were ready to go straight into literary criticism.
You're going to have to scream it. I heard Bob Hollander.
Bob Hollander, the Dante professor, said you were ready to go straight into literary criticism when you were a student of his. Have you ever thought of adding that to the title?
Bob Hollander said that about me?
Yeah.
Honestly?
Yeah.
No, I mean, honestly, that comes as a complete surprise to me. I know we're laughing, but I'm honored, you know? That's beautiful. What was the question? Oh, will I go into literary criticism? I can't get away from it because I think if you read Bucky fucking Dent, there's a lot of citations of great literature in it. And I think in my head, I'm lucky enough to have a library, an imperfect and an incomplete library. Like, I've been in a room with Harold Bloom, and he has a library in his head that is verbatim of really the history of the canon of English. It's just an awesome thing to behold. Mine is fragmentary and incomplete, but I've got stuff in there rattling around. And this is one of my problems with Googling, is that I do believe that it's good to actually have the knowledge inside your head and not in your pocket. Because it rattles around in there and makes, we can clap all we want, but we're doomed. it rattles around and it makes new stuff. And it's different if it's outside of your brain, I think. So I think I can't help but be a literary critic, even in my so-called fictional writing, because I have so much, I'm lucky enough to have been given so much access to the best writing that we have been able to do as a species. So
I want to take one more question. Can we get somebody in the back on that side?
She's waving really
okay.
Hard.
In the front.
Well, we'll get in the back too. We can keep going.
Please.
So when I was a teen, I was completely obsessed with X-Files. To the point, I said people call me Dana. Do you mind sharing one of perhaps your most favorite memories from doing X-Files?
I've been asked to share a favorite memory of doing the X-Files. There's many, many memories. It was a long, we worked We worked a long time. It was a while ago. So I think I would share with you, if I could, the idea that rather than just a specific memory, the idea that I was able to kind of teach myself how to do my job. You know, when I got that job, I wasn't that young, but I was very green because I had been doing other things and besides acting. You know, so I really didn't know what I was doing, but I thought I did, which was lucky. It's very lucky if you think you know what you're doing, unless you're running for president. But it's lucky if you're an artist if you think you know what you're doing when you don't. As long as it doesn't stop you from asking questions. So I didn't know what I was doing, but I thought I was doing something. And I was able, because of the sheer amount of work, it was a really hard show to do back then, harder than it is even to do it now. And we were working like the 14-hour days in the rain in Vancouver, and it was tough physically and mentally and always. But glorious in another way. You know, just to be working was amazing. And, you know, eventually I got to a point where I started to realize how I had no idea what I was doing. But by the time I realized that I didn't know what I was doing, I kind of knew what I was doing. And I think that in all other spheres of life, except, again, politics and maybe surgery, this is a good process to go through. And one needs mentors and co-workers to help you through. And to not burst your bubble so much and say, hey, you don't know what the fuck you're doing, that's awful. But to kind of, I think I've had good teachers along the way. I've had good coaches when I played sports. Especially, I think, in sports I learned a lot about art and collaboration. So that's what I tell my kids all the time. You know, I try and just get them to keep showing up, you know. So I think that would be my story about the X-Files, was that I kept showing up.
And the last question, if we could just get somebody in the back, either side here. Just somebody pop up. That lady right there.
So
yes, you.
You said you had an immense library. That's pretty good. Not like Carl Hewlett, but an immense library. You talked about art a bit. I wonder if part of that library that you're sort of mentioning, without specifically mentioning it, is that in the art of motorcycle maintenance? Because you also talked about the greater good.
I was just talking about what?
The greater good, doing things for good.
The greater good?
Yeah.
I'm not sure I understood the question.
I'm wondering if one of the books in your mental library...
Is that in the art of motorcycle maintenance?
Yeah.
I have read it, but I don't remember it. So I can see it. It's kind of purplish. Is it purplish? The cover is purplish. Motorcycles never got me crazy, so I was like halfway not there. It didn't stick with me so much, but maybe it's the kind of a thing where it stuck with me so much that I deliberately forgot it so that I could rip it off. Apparently that's what did I do then, did I rip it off? Sometimes you rip stuff off, you don't know. That's the great thing about having the imperfect library. See, if I was Googling, I would have gone, oh, I ripped it off, I can't do that now. So you wouldn't have it. I'm sure that wasn't your question. I apologize. I couldn't really hear it.
Ladies and gentlemen, on that note, David has kindly agreed to sign paid member books outside, so if you could just line up, queue up orderly, and please join me in thanking the one and only David.